Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass, and I'm very glad you're with us today. This month, the Baltimore Sun brought to light that juvenile offenders in Maryland are routinely stripped, searched, and shackled. The General Assembly is looking at bills that would limit strip searches and shackling. Senator Anthony Muse, Democrat of Prince George's County, proposes to prohibit using mechanical restraints on young people and using physical restraints on a young woman who is pregnant or in labor. The bill would also permit the search of a child only when there is, quote, individualized and reasonable suspicion, close quote, of concealed contraband that poses a risk to safety. Sam Abed, who has headed the Department of Juvenile Services for 5 years, told legislators that shackling and strip searches are necessary to keep both young people and DJS employees safe. At a Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee hearing 2 weeks ago, Abed was asked about detainees who earn a weekend pass to visit family.
When they return, yes, they are strip searched. When they're on a home pass, they are at home, unsupervised. They've spent the night. Anyone could have been with them. And then they're coming back into a secure environment. And when we're having kids coming into a secure environment, we cannot allow contraband to penetrate our facility. It becomes an underground economy. It can cause all kinds of problems. And the other issue is about safety. When we have kids coming into our facilities, it's not just the drugs or the weapons that could come in. We look at things like suicide risk. And when somebody is charged with an offense and they have a lot of pressure on them, they're feeling a lot of pressure, anyone can be a risk of suicide.
DJS Secretary Sam Abed, a lot of the issues we're going to talk about this hour mentioned in that short clip there. Last fall, Maryland's chief judge issued a policy that the presumption will be not to shackle young people in court. That matches the policy in 23 other states and Washington, D.C. But youth advocates say the shackling remained common in the courtroom for months afterwards. Judges can decide on a case-by-case basis if there is a need for restraints. So in this hour, we're going to look at the policies regarding shackling and strip searching young detainees. Most youth who come into contact with juvenile services have histories of trauma. Does strip searching them do more harm than good? Is the rehabilitation and treatment that young people have a legal right to being chipped away by the dehumanizing impact of shackling and strip searching? Joining me to give us some insight into all this is Audra Harrison. She's director of the Office of Public Information for the Department of Juvenile Services. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me on today.
Also here is Nick Maroney, director of the Maryland Juvenile Justice Monitoring Unit, a part of the Attorney General's office that does quarterly reviews of how juvenile justice is working in Maryland. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks.
And Melanie Shapiro, chief attorney for the Public Defender's Juvenile Court Division in Baltimore City. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Melanie, what do young people tell you about being shackled or strip searched? What do you hear from them about the impact it has?
Sure. The most common description they give is they describe it as feeling like they're being treated like an animal. They have a hard time concentrating on what we're talking about to them. They're often, if we're in the courtroom and they're shackled, I don't want to use the word playing, but touching the hand restraints that are on them. Several times they will describe it as being uncomfortable or too tight or hurting them. If we talk to them in the lockup area after they've been transported from the courtroom back, and they do that with both the hand restraints on and the leg restraints on, they often complain that it's painful and that it hurts them. And so it is demoralizing and dehumanizing to them.
Those are the shackles. Do they talk to you about strip searches, or is that kind of over and done by the time you tend to talk to them?
So the strip searches tend to be done not in the courtroom setting. It would be done when they go back into a detention center or a committed placement facility. So our contact with them for court proceedings are normally over. The conversation for that would occur more during a visit to them in the detention center or in the committed placement facilities.
But we should probably, before we go any further, define terms. Audra, what is a strip search? I mean, how I think a lot of us feel like we have sort of a gut understanding of it, but is there a particular way that the Department of Juvenile Services describes this kind of search? Because it is in policy that it be done.
Yes. And, you know, a search is done when a youth at intake and whenever they have contact with the outside. A search is where the youth is asked to disrobe. They are disrobed in a private room with a staff member of the same sex, and actually two staff members are required to be there, and it is a visual search only.
So there's no touching?
There is no touching.
What happens if, for some reason, the staff doing the search think that something is concealed within a body cavity?
Well, then there's a medical, then a medical professional is called in to perform a further search.
Okay. So that's the strip search. What is, describe the shackling. What is a shack? I mean, this is radio, so we don't have a picture to show people. What?
Mechanical restraints.
Yeah, what is that?
There are mechanical restraints, and actually restraints around the wrists and restraints around the feet, and they are combined together in the middle. Now, there are, and I'll let Nick, because Nick's pulled the page open.
I should explain that the latest report from the Juvenile Justice Monitoring Unit, the annual report that was issued just a few weeks ago, has a page or two about this issue, including some photos of shackles. So, Nick, yeah, you describe them.
Yeah, so just to clarify a wee bit, so the bills that are cross-filed on shackling and strip searching are about indiscriminate strip searches and indiscriminate shackling. So the bills don't say that there will never be a situation where a kid may need to be, you know, perhaps in some kind of emergency situation, that a kid might need to be, with proper individualization and documentation, strip searched or shackled for transportation. But that there should not be, that this should not happen to everybody as the default. In terms of shackling, kids are shackled. They are in handcuffs as far as wrists are concerned. They're in leg cuffs as far as the leg is concerned. And then the handcuffs are attached to a box around, which is secured around the stomach by a belly chain. So that's how the kids are.
So how heavy is all this metal?
It depends on the shackles. I mean, they're metal. They're a number of pounds. I don't know the poundage precisely.
I'm glad you focused, Nick Maroney, on this word indiscriminate, because I got the impression, Audra Harrison, from listening to Secretary Abed's testimony before the Senate committee, that he does not accept the description of the shackling of these two practices, shackling in particular, as indiscriminate.
Correct.
So tell me what the department's thinking is.
Yes. Well, the use of searches and restraints are done in prescribed objective standards. They're prescribed situations. So as I said, there are searches done at intake and there are searches done with contact with the outside. That is not indiscriminate. In fact, that's prescribed, the opposite of indiscriminate. So these are standards that are...
But let me understand. I do understand that something like two-thirds of the young people with whom DJS deals are not affected by this. They're in situations that, like group homes, that are not secure. They don't get strip shirts. They don't get they don't wear leg irons when they're transported.
Right.
But for the one-third, or about 3,000 young people in an average year, I think, who are detained in secure facilities, all of them are strip searched on intake.
Correct.
And all of them, if they leave the secure facilities, do that in shackles, correct?
And not all are restrained. Those in secure facilities are restrained during transport. And we have to look at where are we most vulnerable. And a youth going to court or actually driving in a van with a group of other youths in the van that just received their sentence from a judge because of their lack of impulse control, that creates quite a vulnerability, not only to the other youth in the van, the driver, and the communities. So we have to have objective standards and really minimize risk wherever possible.
Oh, a quick clarification before your next question. So the vast majority of, kids who come in contact with DJS by way of a complaint and come into an office, They're not strip searched and shackled right then and there. But the kids who go are committed by the courts do go through detention centers before they go to a group home or somewhere else, usually. So while they're in the detention center, those kids will be subject to strip searches, will be subject to shackling if they need to be transported to court or to a medical appointment.
And to that point, if I may, you know, we saw a recent example of the real problems after intake here in Baltimore City in the adult correctional facilities, where the individual that was alleged to have killed his coworker at the Department of Public Works soon after intake committed suicide. And the fact is, when we get these children and they are sentenced to one of our facilities by a judge, they have been deemed, particularly those in insecure facilities, they have been deemed a public safety risk by a judge. We don't know their state of mind. We have to assess and we have to make sure that they are ready to receive their placement. And so we just don't know what they'll do. But that individual that was alleged to have killed his coworker committed suicide. In an adult facility.
And that was an adult.
Yeah, and so with youth, because of their lack of impulse control, that risk rises exponentially, particularly after intake. So we have to be careful. We don't know these youth. We have to make sure that they're okay, and we minimize risks, not only to them, but other youth in our facilities and our staff.
Yeah, I don't want to take up the conversation. I'm sure Melanie has a lot to say on this as well, but there's also the re-traumatization and the traumatization of kids that's involved in terms of strip searching everybody, in terms of shackling everybody. When a person is brought to a detention facility, they may not have seen a judge. They may have been brought by the police, and they're going to go through intake, and they're going to go through that process of strip searches, et cetera. Also, the majority of kids who are in secure detention in a detention facility have not yet been to a court. So, yes, they've been picked up. They may have done something. They may have been part of a group of people that did something, or they may have done nothing. They just may have been in the wrong place at the wrong time or been hanging around outside, and something happened or didn't happen, and they were picked up, and they're going to be subject to these particular practices.
Well, and on that point,
we need to take a short break here.
Sure,
and
but
so we'll,
I do want to talk about trauma.
We will pick up on this when we come back from a short break with Audra Harrison, Director of the Office of Public Information for the Department of Juvenile Services, Nick Maroney, Director of the Maryland Juvenile Justice Monitoring Unit, and Melanie Shapiro, whom we haven't heard much from, but we will, Chief Attorney for the Public Defender's Juvenile Court Division in Baltimore City. If you have a comment or a question about this issue, please give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Shackles and strip searches, those practices are routine in the Department of Juvenile Services. Children and teens forced to wear mechanical restraints even when being transported home for the weekend and subjected to strip searches when they return. Are these practices necessary to maintain security? Does the psychological impact outweigh concerns over contraband? What goes through your head when you hear about these practices? We're taking your calls at 410-662-8780 and your emails at midday@wypr.org. I'm speaking with Nick Maroney, Maryland's Juvenile Justice Monitor, Melanie Shapiro, Chief Attorney for the Public Defender's Juvenile Court Division in Baltimore, and Audra Harrison, spokesperson for the Department of Juvenile Services. And let me first give Melanie a chance to jump in on what we've been discussing. It seems to me that one of the things Audra has done for us is sort of focus on the distinction between young people and adults in how this this restraint works?
Yes. So there are differences between kids and adults. The whole purpose of the juvenile system is supposed to be rehabilitation. And also it's supposed to be an individualized determination for each child. So each kid who comes into court and goes to court has a decision made based on what is best for that particular child. And so what we're asking to happen is that for strip searches and for shackling, that an individual decision be made for that child that it is absolutely necessary.
Before either one of those would happen?
Yes. And so the distinction as well is that for the majority of the children in the juvenile court system, and even those who are in the most secure level of placement, so the they've gone to court, been found guilty, in need of placement, and then sent to a hardware secure placement where these practices are routine, the majority of them still, the most serious offense is a misdemeanor.
But sure. I would think that Audra would tell us we can't take the risk of letting kids in the system when we don't know what contraband they may be carrying. We don't know what their impulse control is.
Thank you, Sheila. I appreciate that. And let me just say a couple things. First of all, you know, as Melanie well knows, the court has made the decision that this youth poses a public safety risk. So that is why they are in our facilities. The department, particularly under Secretary Abbott, has worked very hard to get the youth in our system that really shouldn't have contact out of the system, okay? There have been significant reforms that even the OPD and JJMU have lauded the department, as well as the Casey Foundation. So that said, when we talk about decisions by a court, that is a decision by the court, and we don't second-guess that.
Except that we do know of situations that the Juvenile Justice Monitor has detailed of young people who are partway through, or even almost all the way through their time with you, who are deemed safe enough to go home for the weekend. I think it shocked a lot of people to read in the Baltimore Sun that they're transported in shackles and they come back to a strip search.
Yes, because they've had contact with the outside. And we'd love to think that there are, you know, in a perfect world, there wouldn't be contraband coming back into our facilities. But as the monitor has noted over the years, the contraband still makes its way in. And first and foremost, we have to ensure that the safety of our facilities, the safety of our youth, and the safety of our staff is paramount, is the foundation of what we do, so that the treatment can be accessed by those youth.
Let me let Melanie address what you just said, since you raised the point that it would be better not to do this kind of thing until a judge has said this particular kid needs these particular procedures.
It wouldn't necessarily be a judge that would have to determine that. It would just be that in the placement facility right now, any child who comes into contact with the public in a detention or hardware secure facility is subject to a strip search after that, whether it's the attorney or a parent or someone else coming in to visit, or the child returning from a home pass. And to suggest that after somebody who's come to visit, there is a thorough search process that the individual needs to go through prior to entering the detention facility. There's DJS staff that can monitor those visits. And to think that a child is going to have a home visit or to have a visit from their family in a facility or their attorney and then have to be strip searched afterwards, I think that the trauma of that certainly outweighs any possible security concern outside an individualized determination that something has happened. Every content that you bring into the detention facility or the committed placement facility is gone through by the Department of Juvenile Services. So I think that to subject a child to a strip search after that kind of visit is overly traumatizing outside an individualized, particularized security concern.
But with all due respect, an individualized assessment has been made by the courts, and the OPD and the state have weighed in on that. So that is done. And the fact is, you know, when we talk about misdemeanants, you know, last year alone, the department recorded nearly 400 assaults in our facilities by misdemeanants. And for your listeners to understand, misdemeanor offenses include second-degree assault. They include intent to distribute drugs. These are significant crimes. And so that said, we also believe that low offense level is not a predictor of behavior of a youth. And so we have to take every precaution possible to ensure the safety of the youth, safety of our staff and of our facilities. Because if we do not have safe facilities, there's no way treatment is going to work. And we believe in these kids. We know treatment can work.
I think that is perhaps where some listeners are having some cognitive dissonance, because it sounds as if you don't trust these kids at all.
Absolutely, and I really not. We've gotten a lot of the kids that we believe shouldn't be in the system, we've gotten them out, and the OPD and the monitor have really supported the efforts that the department has done. And so that said, we're taking many more youth charged as adult. In fact, today, as of today, in the Baltimore City Juvenile Justice Center here in Baltimore, there are twice as many youth charged as adult than there are youth for youth offenses.
Let me ask.
So we're taking the tougher kids.
Let me ask Melanie whether that changes the way you approach this if you're talking about a juvenile charged as an adult compared to one who's not. Do you think there should be different procedures, perhaps the strip search is more, or the shackles are more justified?
Well, I believe that juveniles are juveniles. We supported legislation that was presented to the House and the Senate this year that would ask that all juveniles start in the juvenile system regardless of the offense for which they're charged. So I think that kids are kids, and that an individualized decision needs to be made for each child. We're also talking, if they're charged as an adult, they are generally, if they're in the Department of Juvenile Services care, they're awaiting a transfer hearing, which is a proceeding in the Circuit Court for Baltimore City to determine if they can be sent back down to the juvenile system because they are amenable to the services there. So at that point in time, it's not been determined what court system they're even going to be in, and they should be treated as a juvenile. They are still kids. They are 16, 17 years old. I would also respond to a comment made previously regarding that these kids are some sort of high security risk. There was a report done by the Department of Juvenile Services in conjunction with the Annie E. Casey Foundation looking at the kids in the committed placement facilities. These are the hardware secure facilities, and it was found that 27% of them were there for technical violations of probation. That means kids who failed to report to case managers and weren't going to school and were not complying. In addition, 59% of them were assessed to be low to medium risk kids. Now, I understand that there's a continuum of care, but there are these kids who are low or medium risk kids who are in these secure facilities who are being subjected to this shackling and the strip searching.
Let me ask whether Nick Maroney,
yeah, I'd like
the
to
juvenile
certainly
justice monitor.
Add to that. I agree with what Melanie said, because that's the data. In terms of the photographs and the situation in our latest report of a girl being shackled to go home during the Christmas break, a break that she had earned after being there for some months, in that particular situation, and this is a regular occurrence because these places tend to be far away from metropolitan areas that the kids come from, this kid's parents, for whatever reason, couldn't come pick the kid up. Either they didn't have the wherewithal, or they didn't have they couldn't get away from work, or whatever it was. And so by mere fact that the child then had to be transported using a DJS transportation van, the child was subject to the shackling. If the kid had been picked up by her folks, that would not have happened. Also, yes, the courts have made a determination in, let's say, the Carter Center, since we're talking about that the Carter Center is the only hardware secure or basically maximum security facility for girls in the state. Over this past quarter, for most of the quarter, there were 7 girls there. There was not a very serious charge or a charge of violence involved for any of those girls. But what happened is, because there's a gap in the spectrum of services, if a judge or magistrate sentences or finds a kid responsible and decides the kid needs a certain type of... In Maryland, the magistrate or judge can decide the level of security they think the kid merits or should have, but can't decide exactly where the kid should go. If, as has happened in a lot of cases with the girls at Carter, it's determined that the kid only needs or requires or should have a sort of medium level of security, a staff secure situation. In other words, we'll be going out of home, but we'll be going to a place where you're relying on the staff. You're not relying on a big fence. You're not relying on locks. But if there is no such place for girls in the state, which in fact there isn't, then you may end up in the Carter Center. And so you'll be subject to all of these hardcore procedures that we're talking about.
That's Nick Maroney, the Juvenile Justice Monitor of Maryland, here on Midday on WIPR. Also with us is Melanie Shapiro, Chief Attorney for the Public Defender's Juvenile Court Division in Baltimore, and Audra Harrison, spokesperson for the Department of Juvenile Services.
So one other thing, Sheila. I think Melanie's probably heard this, too, from kids. We've come across kids on a regular basis that say they've told their folks not to come visit because they don't want to be subject to strip searches afterwards. It also puts the public defenders and any other person representing the child in a very awkward situation. If they want to come visit their client, they know that that client is going to be strip searched afterwards. And in terms of the family visits, those are supervised visits. So you come into a room, you're supervised, you have your family visit, and then you go through the strip search.
Okay. I think there's a lot of things here that I'd like to just...
Okay, but I would like to pull somebody else into the conversation first, because we've talked a lot about safety, the safety implications, and Audra, you've made the point that strip searches are necessary for the safety of the staff, so I want to talk to Sue Esty, who is the Legislative and Political Director for AFSCME. Council Number 3, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, represents DJS employees. Sue Esty, welcome to Midday.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
You testified against Senator Muse's bill. What are your major concerns about the limits that some in the legislature are pushing for on strip searches?
Well, actually, there were a ton of technical issues that were problems with the legislation that was introduced. For example, it asked the staff of the Department of Juvenile Services to themselves make a determination of what is a reasonable suspicion, what is an imminent threat of harm, and things like that. And then if they think those things exist, then they were to reach out to the superintendent of the facility before actually taking any action when they think something is happening. The bill also said that restraints could be used if somebody is actively attempting to escape, and it would be, it's very problematic to imagine a situation where one could do that. So there were a lot of technical problems with the bill that really would make it difficult for a regular employee to make a determination on something that's technically a legal issue, such as what is a reasonable suspicion, what is an imminent risk of harm. And then, like on a practical level, if they did see those things, being unable to contact a superintendent is difficult. So I think that is there were some technical issues. I think the other sort of overall big issue is an issue of safety, and I think you've been talking about that quite a bit. And there are instances where staff have been assaulted, I think almost 40 times in recent years, and 55 times, wait a minute, I'm sorry,
I think we've just lost Sue Esty, but I think she made her, at least the points that she most wanted to make. It strikes me, Audra Harrison, that part of what you're saying is we just can't know. We can't know which kids are really at risk.
Yes.
And on the other hand, the secretary testified that there is and he called it an instrument, an assessment tool, a way of assessing a young person to figure out what kind of risk they pose. I think it must trouble some listeners to hear we just can't tell, so we got to restrain all these kids, and we have to assume that any of them may come back with contraband. Is there no middle ground? Is there no way of having a better sense of which kids pose the most risk?
Well, again, I mean, there's a foundation here of safety, first and foremost. From there, a judge has made a determination that that youth is a public safety risk. And from there, the department has to be able to have tools, not based on subjective standards, which is what the OPD and the monitor are advocating for. And subjective
OPD
standards...
OPD is Office of Public Defender.
Yes, I'm sorry, pardon, acronyms. But that subjective standards, which is what the advocation here is for, it will actually introduce more bias into the system. And as for those lower high-level youth, Melanie's quite aware of the fact that Secretary Abbott has introduced the graduated responses. So those youth that are being sentenced for technical violations, this secretary has worked incredibly hard to get them out of the system. There have been significant reforms in the department, but no reform will work if the safety of our facilities is not first at the root of all we do.
We have a call from David calling us from Baltimore. David, welcome to Midday.
Hi, appreciate it. I worked at Baltimore City Juvenile Justice Center for 2 years as a therapist, and the sheer amount of sort of illicit narcotics that was in the facility was sort of astounding. And I understand, you know, the need, or I understand the ability for strip searching and shackling, you know, to re-traumatize these kids. But at the same time, the amount of kids that were nodding out in the facility with, you know, unknown, mostly Suboxone, but unknown drugs posed like a pretty serious health risk for a lot of the kids. I don't see the need for shackling per se, because they're going to come back anyway. And, you know, whether or not they're shackled, they'll still have the drugs on them. But the strip searching seemed really, really valuable.
David, I appreciate the call. Let me, before I ask our panel to address your point, let me add to it an email that we got from Johanna in Baltimore, who asks, how often is contraband found? I've heard that it is DJS staff who are often the ones who bring drugs into controlled facilities. Let me say, I don't know what that is based on. Are staff members ever searched before coming to work? Johanna asks.
And the fact is, we really have to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. And frankly, the secretary of the department is searched when he enters a facility.
That's a pat down.
That's the reality.
At least that's what he said. But there is a difference between
searched.
A pat down and
yes,
a strip search.
But contraband, as your caller David brought up, is a major problem. And as Sue can speak to as well about not only the dangers that they cause, but the underground economy. And over the years, the monitor has advocated for stronger, random, thorough searches. And so this has been a bit of a 180 since last year.
No, because not strip searches. Completely different.
You have said frequent physical searches can reduce the possibility as objects such as these sharpen metal object from ending up in
youth.
We're going to need to sort this
thorough
out, and I need to take a short break before we do that. So we're going to take a short break
notice.
Here. Audra Harrison is talking away as I say that. Melanie Shapiro, Chief Attorney for the Public Defender's Juvenile Court Division, is with us, and Nick Maroney, Maryland's Juvenile Justice Monitor. You can join this conversation by calling us at 410-662-8780 or sending us an email at midday@wypr.org. When we come back, we will pick up this point of what the Juvenile Justice Monitor's recommendations have been and for how long. I'm Sheila Cast. Hope you'll stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're discussing the practices of shackling and strip searching juvenile offenders in Maryland, how often these practices occur and what psychological impact they may have on young people. I'm speaking with Melanie Shapiro, Chief Attorney for the Public Defender's Juvenile Court Division in Baltimore, with Audra Harrison, spokesperson for the Department of Juvenile Services, and Nick Maroney, Maryland's Juvenile Justice Monitor. You can join the conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or call us. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. When we broke for that break, Nick Maroney, Audra had described as sort of an about-face in the last year or so what the Juvenile Justice Monitor has been saying about the value of strip searches.
Well, that would be a problem if it was in fact the case, but it's not. Another point that's very closely related to this is that...
wait a minute. Before you move to your other point...
Right. Well, I think this is very germane. The department has not, at least to date, been able to produce any data showing how much contraband has been gotten as a result of strip searches.
Well, the JJMU has itself reported that last year we had 78 incidents of security contraband in our facilities. And for your listeners, security contraband are weapons... they are a variety of harmful devices, drugs, that sort of thing. And so contraband is a real danger in our facilities. And it's been monitored, or it's been reported on by the monitor, and it's one of the things that we really need to ensure stays out.
Absolutely.
Through safety
I agree with that, but it's actually the contraband that we've come across is usually within the facility, and the weapons that have been made, which is a rare occurrence but does happen, is usually fashioned from something that was gleaned within the facility.
So, Nick Maroney, is your point that doing a strip search when someone has been in contact with the public does not really find the contraband at the point where it's most likely to be found? I'm not sure the implications of what you just said.
What I would like to know is precisely how many times security-related contraband, and specifically weapons or something that could reasonably be argued could be made into a weapon, has been found as a result specifically of strip searches.
As opposed to being found some other way?
Yes.
I don't know whether you have what you need to answer.
Well, the department was asked at a hearing in the last couple of weeks, and they weren't able to produce any data to that effect.
Well, we don't capture the data in that way. We record an incident.
So we don't know whether the strip searches or some other method is finding this contraband. There seems to be agreement that contraband is a bad thing.
Yeah. And what I do know is that the monitor in its last annual report said that our facilities are safer than in the past. And these tools, the use of restraints and the searches, contribute to the safer environment. And frankly, that's why...
Well, I said the first part. We didn't say the second part of that.
That's why... I understand. And it's only logical to say that
these
tools...
Not necessarily.
Well, I understand that that's your position and opinion right now. But that said, we have to ensure, and Sue's membership and folks at the department who work day in and day out in our facilities know that this legislation would take us back and put more kids in harm's way. And frankly, I would ask listeners to understand what is more traumatic, seeing someone shanked, themselves getting shanked in a facility, someone ODing or hanging themselves, or an individual facing
okay,
a
I
search.
Should I should just point out that from what I've read, there have not been suicides among young people, at least in recent years.
There haven't, but the reality is...
Let me pull
is,
Sue Esty back into this conversation.
Yes.
Sue Esty from Ask Me has rejoined us, and if I understand correctly, Sue, you've got some information about contraband?
Well, just a couple of things, really. And I want to preface it by saying that for our members, I think that they really do feel a lot of concern and compassion for people. But that's why they're concerned about assaults. And in the last 2 years, there's been over 600 assaults of kids assaulting other kids and about 160 of kids assaulting employees. Now, this is unusual.
But I'm trying to understand, Sue Esty, I'm trying to understand the connection between those assaults, certainly not a happy statistic. What is the connection between those assaults and either of the practices we're talking about, the shackling or the strip searches?
Well, I think the question really goes back down to contraband as well. There were 75 instances where contraband was confiscated in the past year, and it was only a few years ago that a teacher was murdered that worked for the Department of Juvenile Services. So the potential exists for there to be a significant harm done if there's not enough safety measures taken.
Right, but in that 2010 case in particular, was that related to a failed strip search? In other words, was that 2010 murder, a horrible thing, was that related to these practices?
Well, I think that is related only in this way. The kid that did that was considered a low-risk individual, and I think some of the conversation has been that low-risk individuals should not be searched. That kid was not searched because they were considered low-risk and they were not in a secure facility. But once you're in a secure facility, that's where these kind of strip searches take place.
Well, the kid was in a secure facility, just wasn't inside the fence at Cheltenham. And I reported on that particular situation, which was a heinous situation. Mm-hmm. But to paint every child is very misleading. To paint every child in DJS custody as potentially being a child that troubled and to do that kind of thing is extremely misleading. And it doesn't matter if you, quite frankly, had shackled that child multiple times a day or had strip searched that child multiple times a day. The fact is that the biggest cluster that happened in that particular situation was lack supervision and bad management.
Nick, I'm sorry, but I don't think, and Sue, if I can step on your toes a bit, that's not at all what Sue is saying, that she's painting in some way. I think that's a characterization that I think is unfair. We care about these kids, and the fact is, the point is that a low risk of level should not be a predictor of behavior, and we can't take any chances. We have a razor-thin margin of error in already challenging situations. So this legislation would increase the likelihood of contraband, of danger to children. And what is more traumatizing, a search or a murder?
This comes back down to a kid who is leaving a facility, let's say for an earned home pass. You know, if the child has the wherewithal, the child goes home, hangs with her parents, guardians, whatever, in the car. Going via your transportation, that child is shackled up. You know, that's what it comes down to. The everyday routine experience of something that is not necessary in every case. We're not saying that there should never be another strip search. We're not saying that you should never, ever shackle a child. However, you really need to have a good reason to be doing these things.
But what you are saying is that we should use subjective standards which introduce bias. And that is...
Melanie, your point?
Yes, I was just going to add that the shackling and strip searching often happens as well when kids are admitted to detention, which sometimes happens before they've even seen a court. So they've not been deemed any type of security concern. They've been arrested. They have been processed through the Department of Juvenile Services, and they are detained for a variety of reasons to come to court the next court day. They've not necessarily been found guilty of anything. They have not been even seen a court for their first court appearance for an arraignment or had an attorney assigned. And if they are determined by the Department of Juvenile Services to be in need of detention before that court hearing, then they are strip searched. And if, depending on what facility they're taken to, they are shackled for that transportation as well.
Everyone at this table has expressed concern about the welfare of the kids. Let's talk to Cheryl, who is calling us from Catonsville. Cheryl, welcome to Midday.
Yes, good afternoon. I did miss some of the beginning, so I didn't get it all. But I am concerned to move the conversation. Yes, I know we're talking about strip searching on a practical level and the shackling and the transport and the safety. But I think there has to be a dignity criteria set up as well and considered for both, you know, kids and staff alike. And I think I don't hear much of that, you know, I mean, kids, I think one way that someone does hit it is that all kids aren't the same. And so the instruments that you're using need to take into account that variability. And it sounds like there's some of that, but I'm not sure there's all of that. And I think his name is Nick, mentioned what is, you know, are we monitoring the violent incidents that happened based on strip searches? So if that data isn't being collected, if we can't say a violent incident that happened with something that was collected from a strip search, that data isn't being collected versus some other way, then I think that doesn't take into account the variability of the children's potential risk to taking behavior and doesn't put their first, sort of their first safety and staff considerations, safety considerations in place if those instruments aren't placed to link the strip searches to specific kinds of, whether or not that or some other kind of search is what yields violent, instruments. And so I think there's a dignity question that needs to be sort of just put,
Cheryl,
into the picture as we're talking about this.
I appreciate your raising the dignity question. Does that come... Is that something that the Department of Juvenile Services worries about, the dignity
Absolutely.
Of these kids?
Absolutely. And let me say, the dignity, particularly with searches of the youth, is is absolutely part of the calculation. That is why it is done by a same-sex member of staff and two staff members present. Look, these are not pleasant policies, but these, you know, there are, we cannot account for anything. And so the dignity is very important, but safety has to be paramount. And to Melanie's point, again, about intake and they haven't been seen by a judge, I bring up, again, the man in the adult facility.
Right,
who
and you have
himself.
Brought that up before. We,
and you
we
have less
a,
control
we have
of their
a, an email from Ben who asks, why aren't strip searches replaced by body scanners like those used by the TSA? And we also had a caller who asked if there is another way to do a search that is not so dehumanizing.
Yeah.
Nick, is this something that you've looked into? Or Melanie, do you know of alternatives?
Well, there are scanners, and that would certainly be likely to pick up any, you know, metal-related implements or instruments or potential tools, problematic tools. That's not going to capture perhaps very small quantities of drugs, but it would capture potential weaponry, I would think.
We're very tight on time, and let me just, Sue Esty, ask you to address very quickly. Is this in part a staffing question? If there were more staff, would it be possible to do fewer strip searches? Is there a trade-off here?
Well, I don't think there are enough staff, but I don't know that this is related to that.
Okay.
We do have situations, though, I'd just like to add, where one of our members was fired this year when a child that she was transporting in a van who was wearing restraints escaped. So the restraints, even with restraints, there are still dangers of potential for escape. And more importantly, if somebody is unrestrained and acts on impulse and is running away, one of our concerns is also that they be harmed while being physically restrained by a member of law enforcement. So just a couple of other 2 cents there.
Melanie, we really have just a minute or two left. And one thing we haven't talked about much is the effect of the shackling in the courtroom. From your observation, how did the adults, other adults in the courtroom react to a young defendant being shackled?
It's a shocking sight to see a young child come into the courtroom restrained. Often the kids have a hard time walking because of the leg restraints. They trip quite frequently. You hear the loud clanking as they walk. It's a shocking sight to see. There have been steps taken and progress made to eliminate that practice in the courts in Maryland. And so hopefully soon we won't see any child unless they've created some extreme circumstance shackled in the courtroom at all. I would just like to add, you know, we talk a lot about the safety and security, and I agree that's paramount, but the goal of juvenile services is supposed to be rehabilitation.
And that is the point on which we have to end because we are flat out of time. I'm very grateful to you all for helping us understand
this. You can't have rehabilitation
without
safety. Audra
Harrison, speaking now, is spokesperson for the Department of Juvenile Services. Melanie Shapiro, chief attorney for the Public Defender's Juvenile Court Division. And Nick Maroney, Maryland's Juvenile Justice Monitor. And I want to thank all of them, and I want to thank you for listening. Tomorrow at noon, the same topic I told you about yesterday, but really, tomorrow we will learn how community land trusts can create permanently affordable housing. I hope you'll be with us tomorrow. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.